Morning, everybody. It's so lovely to be with you all, and very weird that I can't see you or smile at you or see you smiling back at me, but I'll just imagine it. I'm having an absolutely fantastic trip to New Zealand. I've met several of the palliative care teams and services over here, so hello to the pals I've already met. And I really feel as though I'm here amongst my tribe today. Thank you so much for inviting me. So, as some of you will know, I worked as a consultant in palliative medicine in the UK for many years. I spent 30 years in palliative care and 10 years in medical care before that as a junior doctor and as a medical student. And over that period of time, I really discovered that I went to medical school knowing nothing about dying, and that I went through my first few years as a junior doctor knowing that dying was a thing that my job was to prevent. And so it wasn't until I got to working in a hospice for the first time, when I'd been qualified for 5 years, that I heard dying being described to a patient by a very wise physician and realized that actually that was an immensely reassuring and helpful thing for a patient. So over the last couple of years, realizing that still the public knows nothing about dying and junior doctors still so focused on stopping dying that they don't step back to notice the occasions when it's unstoppable and what we should be doing is managing it instead, I decided to try and do something about the public understanding of dying, and through a series of very bizarre coincidences ended up writing a book, which is odd enough in itself, but the book became a bestseller and I got invited to make a little video, and the videos had nearly 3 million hits on Facebook. And that tells me two things. One is that life is so completely unpredictable, which you would have thought a career in palliative care would already have taught me, but apparently I'm a slow learner. But also that people really want to know about this stuff. And so what I want to talk to you about today, and I realize that to some extent I'm preaching to the choir, is how do we help the public to get back that forgotten wisdom that actually we have and that we are practitioners of. So I'm intending to talk for about half an hour, and then I'm hoping we're going to have a question and answer session. So I'm moving now to slide 2. And what we're going to talk about is a little bit of how things currently are, some bad news, some good news, and then go on to talk about public familiarity with normal dying and the process of dying before we start to think about what are we going to do to start to turn the tide and change things. So slide 3 is a graph, and I've only got 3 graphs, so this is the graphs apology warning. So this is a picture of what's happened to life expectancy at birth in the United Kingdom over the last century and a half. And then those extra coloured lines towards the right-hand side of the graph, as you're looking at it, are the New Zealand data. So the first thing is that if you look at the middle section of that graph, you'll see what happened to life expectancy at birth over the 20th century. And my nana, my mum's mum, is a great example of this, because when she was born in 1900, she had a life expectancy of about 55 years. And she, in fact, lived to be 97. And that's because she lived through the changes in healthcare that happened over the second half of the 20th century. So she lived a normal experience of death first half of the 20th century. She helped to nurse her parents dying at home of old age-related diseases when they were in their 40s and 50s. One of her children died of diphtheria, which we routinely immunize children against now. Her husband died in his 30s because his appendix burst and they were poor people. They couldn't go to hospital, and anyway, there were no antibiotics. So he had peritonitis and died at home. So she was, like any person growing up in her era, familiar with what happens as people die. But in 1948, we began our National Health Service, and your health services started actually a couple of years before ours and spread across the island over the next decade and a half. And so there was now availability of hospital and also new developments like antibiotics, better chemotherapy agents, better targeted radiotherapy, better anaesthetics, which meant surgeons could tackle bigger problems. And then, as you know, over the last several decades, organ transplantation, improvements in intensive care facilities, so that now when somebody is young and strong and yet so sick that they might die, we can take them to hospital, we can almost always stop them from dying and restore them back to the state of health that they were in before their disaster struck. So if you look at the last third of this graph, which has got the New Zealand data superimposed on it, so the lines at the top that overlie my data are your, at the top, female, and at the bottom, male data for the general New Zealand population, so that's everybody. And then the lines below are the Maori population, and again, as in all of these graphs, women doing slightly better, but actually with a gap that I know you recognise and people are working very hard to put right. So in New Zealand, as in the UK, in the space of one generation of a family, we lost familiarity with dying and death. We didn't see it anymore. We don't know what to expect. We don't recognize the sequence. And we send our sickest people to hospital to be made well, forgetting that we can only be made as well as we were before the disaster struck. And if that already was extremely flaky, then we save somebody's life to restore them to their previous flaky situation, which may be very precious to them, which is why advanced care planning is so important to help us to know that. The next slide, so I'm moving on to slide 4, is looking at what's happened to life expectancy if you actually get to retirement age. And this is a problem for all of us because we designed our retirement systems and particularly our pension system to support people for a few years so that they could live comfortably in the little bit of time between retirement and death. But look at that curve taking off. So if you get to 65 now, you can expect another 20 years of living if you're a woman, or 18 years of living if you're a man. And our data are almost exactly the same for your islands and ours. And so when we move to slide 5, these are New Zealand data showing the rise that's anticipated in numbers of elderly people in New Zealand, the over 65s, which is going to rocket. But because we're surviving so much longer, even the number of people over the age of 85 is going to rise considerably. And one of the challenges we're going to have is providing sufficient aged care, sufficient places, but also sufficient staffing to look after those people. So moving to slide 6, and this T-shirt was something worn by a patient that I looked after when I was a haematology house officer in the early 1980s. And he was a patient who was coping by being extremely angry and sardonic. And it was his little joke as he walked around the ward, cheering everybody else up as he went with his birth, school, work, death T-shirt. But he didn't know what to expect. He didn't know what he was going to experience. And so slide 7 talks to us about what the difficulty is. So that little explosion that says illness is where we're going to start in this quite complicated slide, which ordinarily would be animated if we were in a lecture theatre together. So we've currently got a model where we're not well. So we have some tests and we have some treatment and we talk to somebody who either tells us that this treatment is going to make us better, or we've got a condition that we're going to be able to live with. But sometimes they have to tell us bad news. They have to tell us that actually we're going to get worse. And at that point, what we see happening to our patients, and in fact what happens even to we who know better, is that we go into this place of projecting forward into how dreadful, terrible, and awful things might be. And so we find that people are drawing on the experience that they have, and that is almost no experience of normal deterioration, normal dying. Plenty of difficult, unhelpful news in the newspapers, on the television, And so people tend not to talk about it. And I've noticed that in New Zealand, just as in the United Kingdom, the use of the D words is falling away. We don't have death and dying and dead anymore. We have passing and passing away. So people are avoiding talking about it, avoiding using the language, avoiding making preparation. And if we don't prepare, then we won't get the symptoms right in time. We won't enable people to be in the place that they would choose to be if they really knew what it was they were choosing about. We won't enable families to make the reconciliations or say the tender things to each other that they always mean to say, but they don't realize that now is the time. And we will have people misinterpreting what they see and hear around the deathbed, and all of this then just perpetuates the belief that dying is terrible, and you go round the loop and reinforce that cloud of horror that we're living with amongst the people that we need to be trying to help. So as I move on to slide 8, looking at the consequences of the current model, first of all, we've got some last remnants of people who are old enough to remember from their childhoods what normal dying is like, but they will be dying over the next decade. And we are losing the experience and the wisdom that those people are able to refer to from amongst our population. So these are the people who are likely to embrace your initiative about advanced care planning. They're likely to have thought about the manner of their living and dying. And one of the things that I find very interesting is how difficult they find it to engage their adult and sometimes elderly adult children in discussing their preferences. One of the tips that I give to my patients back at home is because we live to such a great age, our grandchildren are adults. So just in the way that as a child, you could tell your grandmother something that you couldn't possibly tell your parents about a bad thing you'd done or some trouble that you were in at school. This is payback time, really. So now grandparents can talk to their adult grandchildren who can then persuade parents to engage in these conversations. And I found that quite a successful ploy back at home. As in the United Kingdom, New Zealand populations are becoming more dispersed. Older people and frailer people are less likely to be living close to supportive family members. And we have to remember that we're drawing our healthcare professionals into their training from this population of people that doesn't know, doesn't understand about dying. And it also includes our members of parliament. And I had the pleasure of talking to several of them yesterday about normal dying. And I have to say that I had their very good attention. And you'd be interested to know that Mr. Seymour was amongst them and paid very good attention to what I had to say about end of life and palliative care. So moving on to slide 9, more consequences of people not knowing what to expect is that we in the medical and nursing professions get the rough end of that as well, where we have colleagues who see death as a medical failure, and so they keep trying. They need to do something. And even the expression ceiling of care is something we need to be thinking about. We can have ceilings of intervention. We can have ceilings of treatment. But actually, we never stop caring. And if anything, when we reach a ceiling of intervention, what we do is we double up the caring. So it's more care, not less. But these colleagues with reluctance to admit that they're reaching the limits of possibility often are also the colleagues who are reluctant to say the P word, that I'm going to invite the palliative care service to meet you. So we've got patients and we've got colleagues who are using denial and avoidance as their mechanism of keeping themselves safe. We're losing the language and we don't understand normal and good dying. We just believe public opinion. So people have unrealistic expectations, not just on their own behalf, but on behalf of people who they love, who are entering the phase of life in which they can expect to be dying. We're not talking about it, we're doing denial, and at the same time, we're going out in droves to watch movies about dying, movies about solving complicated murders. My kids, and I'm sure yours, play shoot-em-up games on their computers. So death as entertainment has never been better business, but people don't want to talk about or understand normal dying. So slide 10 is to look at the model that we already have for absolutely excellent anticipatory care planning. And it's what happens when we're looking after somebody who discovers that she's pregnant. Because as soon as the pregnancy is identified, we start to explain the process. So midwifery helps a woman and her birth partner to know what to expect and to plan ahead. So midwives will describe what happens as pregnancy progresses. They'll describe what happens once the labor begins, and they will help the woman to make a plan and also a backup plan. And they'll be really good and not laugh about the idealistic plans, but they will make a backup plan as well, so that when the time comes for labor to begin, the pregnancy has been managed in a way that's kept the mum and the baby as safe as possible, and everybody is now ready to go to that birth bed and do a safe labor. We know who needs to be involved. We know where the woman wants to be. We know what kit and caboodle needs to be in the place that she wants to be. And we're really, really careful about sharing the plan so that if she starts her labor unexpectedly, not in the right place, the person who attends understands, knows the plan, knows how the pregnancy has been, and is ready to step up immediately. Part of the planning is crisis planning. If things are not going to plan, what are you willing to consider and how early? So that delivery care follows a very, very careful period of anticipatory care. And so slide 11 is my attempt to thread together how we do palliative and end-of-life care in the light of the birth experience. So we too have a period of preparatory anticipation. We don't have a blue line on a stick, but we have a moment when there is a diagnosis of a fatal condition, or we have a moment when we realize that actually that condition which was being held in check, like heart failure or respiratory diseases, is now starting to progress again. And we really need to help everybody to understand that actually life is a pretty fatal condition anyway, and that outcomes for life in the United Kingdom and New Zealand are jointly the worst in the world, with fatality at 100%. So we need people to understand the process. Where does this person's experience of life and their hopes for how they might die sit in the scheme of possible ways things might happen? So describing normal dying in the same way that a midwife describes normal birth is a really important part of the service that we offer to people, and then, knowing what to expect, they can start to make a plan. So we know that advanced care planning is going to be a process. It's not going to be an event. And there are people who are filling in your beautiful planning booklet now who will need to tear it up and start again if they develop a different illness that's going to overtake the thing they're currently planning for. There will be people who are filling in the booklet now, which is triggering really, really important conversations within their families, who actually just know that they are mortal and they want their families to know what they think, but who are not yet ill. They don't know yet what the condition is that's going to take them out of life. And so again, they will need to modify and replan as things declare themselves. So as we get closer to understanding how we're going to die, our plan can get more sophisticated. We know who needs to be involved from within our family and our extended family, but we might not yet know who needs to be involved in terms of healthcare professionals until we've got that diagnosis or those diagnoses. We can plan more sensibly and reliably once we know what the illness is. But knowing who knows the plan, how the plan gets shared, and who's appointed to make a choice in a crisis during which competence might be temporarily suspended. The person may recover enough again to express preferences, but may be too unwell for a period to express their preference. So knowing who's going to be the decision maker is really critical. And if we can do that kind of antenatal care well, then we can change deathbed care. We can narrate the deathbed, and I'm going to come on to that a little bit more in a few slides' time. Slide 12, though, is to look at what we're up against. So in the UK, we have very, very unhelpful journalism about healthcare. And those things that look like they've been chopped out of newspapers are largely from our version of the Daily Mail, which constantly undermines the best that we can do in the health service by reminding everybody about how terrible everything is. But I found some New Zealand references. They're very gentle compared with what we're up against in the UK, but I suspect that that will change, and I wish you well as it does. So what these people are reporting, in a way, is like the planes that fall out of the sky, and nobody mentions all of the planes that are still successfully transferring people from A to B. In the same way, most dying is not like these reports, but people who are bereaved, who've watched normal, gentle dying, don't feel inclined to write to the newspapers and say, what I saw was okay. So we're always going to have the outliers reported. And I'm moving on to slide 13, which is looking at images from soap operas and from cinema about death and dying. So some of you I know watch EastEnders here in New Zealand. So in the top left-hand corner with the birthday cake is Ethel, who, despite the fact that she's going to die in a few minutes, still has enough breath left to blow out her birthday candle. So clearly this is a very realistic storyline. In fact, the storyline up to this episode had been very realistic, and in fact, the writers were being advised by somebody from the British Association for Palliative Medicine. But it wasn't interesting enough for a soap opera. So after the birthday cake, the lady in the pearl necklace, Dot, is going to help Ethel to take an overdose of morphine so that viewers will continue to watch instead of getting up to put the kettle on, because that's what entertainment is about. The intensive care unit scene beside it is another not normal death of a young mother during a pregnancy. So the baby's just been delivered by cesarean section, and in a moment the ventilator of the brain dead mother will be turned off. Now, we actually had this happen in the UK about 6 months ago, where a pregnant woman was stabbed and her baby was saved, but she was not. But until then, it was such a rare occurrence that this was a slide that made people laugh. We don't laugh now because we've had it come so close to our home. But again, it talks about the drama that death is described with in television. If you come down to the bottom on the left side, you'll see an unfortunate incident on South Island, where I think the orcs now have mainly been rounded up. But actually, again, it's death in cinema as titivation. So here's Boromir being shot by arrows. And then the last picture, Tom Hanks in the film Philadelphia, is a really faithful description of somebody declining towards death and his gradual loss of energy and his need to sleep more, eventually becoming bedbound, still being able to talk and speak to his family because his disease wasn't impairing his mind. But they still didn't show him die. There was a reconciliation scene with another character, and then they switched to a graveyard, which is a very, very frequent screen formula to get round having to show dying. And just in case you think that it's all Hollywood in the UK, well, don't forget Shortland Street is actually escalating its number of deaths very, very quickly. So up till about 2006, there were 3 or 4 deaths a year in Shortland Street. But if you're a fan, or if, like me, you go on their wiki site, you'll see that over the last 3 years, there's been a huge escalation in the number of deaths because it attracts viewers. In fact, the television company, after the death of the Sarah Potts character, who's the person on the right, had letters begging for a plot twist so that she could be reintroduced. So people really are bothered about their soap operas, and their soap operas are making our job so much more difficult. So moving on to slide 15, and just to summarise really the public understanding of dying, which is based on just not getting good information, getting misinformation and media distortion, so that people are seeing something that sensationalises dying but really trivialises it at the same time. And because our dying people are in hospital, they're not at home, there's a lack of direct experience, or we even start to mistrust our own experience. And this is where we're working, folks. This is where we are trying to deliver a service. And we can't do this on our own. This actually is a public health issue, and it's that that led me to into campaigning. So I want to share briefly with you the way I first heard dying described by my first boss in the hospice. He was talking to an elderly lady, actually a French woman, who had been a member of the French Resistance during the Second World War, and who now was dying of metastatic bowel cancer. And she'd expressed a fear to one of our nurses in hospice that she may be overcome by pain on her deathbed. And if that were to happen, then that would be a disaster for her. This nurse did something really, really important. She didn't try to reassure this lady. She asked this lady what it was about the pain that scared her the most, which was a fantastic opening up of this lady's distress. And in fact, it turned out that it wasn't the pain particularly that was the issue. It was that if she was overwhelmed by pain, she feared she might lose her faith in God as she died. And because she was a French Catholic, her belief was that that would be a mortal sin on her deathbed to despair in God. And so she would not be allowed into heaven, which is where she believed that her very brave British officer husband was waiting for her. So this was an existential and spiritual crisis presenting as fear of pain. So my boss took me with him when he went to talk to her. And he asked her whether she would like to know what dying is really like. And I was absolutely shocked. So I sat quietly towards the bottom of the bed on a little stool while he explained to her about how to start off with whatever illness we're dying from. We have a very similar pattern towards the very end of life of just being more tired, of needing more sleep. And he said to her, "You might already have noticed that." And she said, "Yes, I have." And he said, "Oh, good." And I thought, "Oh, good?" And he said, "Oh, good, that means that you're following the normal pattern. Shall I tell you what we would expect to happen next?" And she said, "Yes." And I thought, this is really uncomfortable. And he said to her, "So what we expect now is gradually that you will become more tired, that you will sleep more, and that will recharge your battery so you can be awake for a while. But as time goes by, you will sleep more and you'll be awake less. Does that sound okay?" And she said, "Yeah, that doesn't sound too bad." And he said, "Okay, so let's think about your pain control. Has your pain been a problem?" And she said, "No, not really." So he said, "Well, it would be unusual for pain to change character at this point in the illness. But one of the things that will happen as time goes by is that during those periods of being asleep, we know that people become unconscious. We know that because we've tried to wake them up. Maybe it's medicine time or there's been a visitor and we can't waken them. When they wake up later on, they say they've had a lovely sleep. So we know that people don't notice as they become unconscious. But once we realize that that's starting to happen, we swap the way we give people's medicines so that they won't miss a dose because they're too sleepy to swallow and then have pain or nausea or whatever their particular symptoms are coming back to disturb them. So probably we'll use injections, probably we'll use a little pump. We won't be increasing the dose, we'll be giving the dose that you have now, but the little pump will make sure you get the right amount of drug each hour to keep you comfortable. Does that sound okay?" And she said, "Yeah, that sounds all right." And I thought, great, he's finished now, she feels better, but no. "So," he said, "as time goes by, what we see is that people are sleeping more and more. And we know that underneath that sleep, they're slipping deeper and deeper into unconsciousness. They're waking less and less until the time comes when people are just deeply unconscious all of the time. And when that time comes, the only bit of the brain that's still working is the bit that manages our breathing. So we see the brain switch to an automatic breathing cycle. And some of the time, that breathing is very deep and it can be a little bit noisy. So if your family are around the bed when that's happening, we'll be sure to explain to them that that doesn't mean you're groaning or trying to speak. It actually is telling us that you're very deeply unconscious. You're not able to feel pain in that state. And some of the time, the breathing cycle will be shallow and a little bit panty, and we'll be sure to explain to your family, if that happens, that that's part of the automatic breathing of being very deeply unconscious. It's not because you're breathless, because we don't want them to see you very comfortable with this automatic breathing and not understand and worry about you. So we will look after your family while they're watching this happen. Is that all right with you? And she said yes. And he said, so at the very end of somebody's life, if your family are around the bed, what they're going to see is that after one of those very gentle out-breaths, there just won't be another in-breath. It's as gentle and as simple as that. There's no sudden rush of pain at the end, no panic or choking or feeling of fading away. It's very, very gentle. Do you think they'll be able to cope with that? And she said, yes. And he said, and will you be able to cope with that? And she said, yes. Thank you. And she picked up his hands and she kissed them and settled back onto the pillows. And I was astonished. Because what I just heard him describe, I recognized. I just didn't realize I'd seen it. In all of those deaths that I'd been working away to prevent so closely that I hadn't stood back to see the pattern, had been this same underlying pattern. I knew that he had been describing something that I'd seen many hundreds of times, but I'd never really seen it before at all. So in my neck of the woods, we refer to that as the coma talk. At a multidisciplinary team meeting, we might say, oh, so I spoke to Mr. Jones yesterday and we had the coma talk. Or I think that Mrs. Smith is almost ready for us to explore her fears, and it might be that the coma talk will be helpful for her. It means that we all know what we all know. And almost always when I have that conversation with a patient, first of all, I have to say, never has anybody stopped me, even though I always start by saying, you stop me at any point, and I do a lot of checks about, is it okay to continue? I've never been stopped in the thousands and thousands of times that I've described dying to people. But almost always at the end, there's a kind of pause, and then they'll say, do you think you could tell my wife that? Well, I think it would be really helpful if my mum and dad knew that. This is a really helpful thing. Understanding normal dying is of huge comfort to people. So slide 17 is my proposal that we should be midwifing dying, that we should be helping people to prepare, knowing what to expect and what the different options are, and in particular, what backup will be available and how to find it, so that if we can, we're arranging a single telephone number so people are not panicking and scrambling at home to find the right person to call. And then that we're monitoring people so that we know what their symptoms are, we have the symptoms tightly managed, and we've got plans in place for a symptom control escape. And sometimes our plans will be step-back plans. If this person becomes so sick that they're imminently dying, they don't want to go to hospital, they don't want to have cardiopulmonary resuscitation, they've declined having further antibiotics. But sometimes they're step-up plans. If this person deteriorates in the next 6 months whilst they're waiting for their first grandchild to be born, they would like all treatments invested in saving their life for as long as possible so they can meet this grandchild, at which point they might want to review the plan. So it's really important that advanced care planning doesn't become a sort of code for do nothing, so that ambulance teams don't think that a family who've got an advanced care plan don't need a blue light. We need to think about the interventions, and that even though we're giving less treatment, as I said before, we're giving more care. And then how do we accompany people at the deathbed? How do we, who are the people in and out of that room, narrate the process and ensure that the family is seeing and hearing and interpreting things the way we are seeing and hearing and interpreting them? So that we're saying frequently, look at what's happening in this room. The way your mum is breathing now is telling me that she's comfortable. The way your child is breathing now is telling me that he's following the normal process. The way your wife is lying there now comfortably is telling me that time is getting short, and do you want to call any other people? So that we're normalizing the dying process, and that every single deathbed that we get to is an opportunity to educate people. So slide 18, which for some reason has turned the grass red and the bottom of the triangle green. I haven't seen any red grass in New Zealand, although actually the golden grasses of Rohan were rather gorgeous. This is my triangle of what we're after. So the bottom level of this triangle is the grassroots. It's the people. It's the people of New Zealand. And it's a community that, when our cunning plan comes to pass, will understand normal dying, will be making plans in advance, will be calling upon the expertise of the people in the next level up, who are their general practitioners, their district nurses, their oncologists, their cardiologists, the people who look after them and their condition day to day, who will be able to advise them about how to take things forward. And those people can call on the minds and the brains and the knowledge of the people in the next layer up, which is the palliative care specialist, who may not need to see all of these patients, but who may need to offer education to the generalists, or may need to see occasional patients as a one-off consultation. But also, the bed symbol there is about the patients whose care we will need to participate in, usually by working alongside their usual teams, because we cannot care for everybody. And then the top of the triangle is strategic planning. It's what the government will do. It's instructions to your health boards about how much they can or should be spending per capita, because it's very different across the islands, I've noticed. And it's about having access not just to physical care, but to the emotional care and the complex psychological and psychiatric care, which is a big gap and which is very specialist into dealing with people who also have physical illness. So moving to slide 19, and we're nearly there now, folks. So here's that illness in the explosion, and we're going around the same loop, but this time, when we're told that this condition is going to get worse, what if we were in a position that healthcare staff who are breaking bad news are able to explore with people what their goals and values are, what are their important relationships, what legacy they hope to leave behind them in terms of lives influenced and love left behind? Because if we can get into that space, then instead of avoidance, we can get into preparation. And if we can get into preparation, then during that antenatal period before dying, we can manage symptoms, both getting them under the best control we can and helping people to have realistic expectations about them. We can talk about the best place for care, the preferred place for care, and what alternatives a person could expect. We can generate those family opportunities for those really important conversations, those conversations that enable peace of mind to the dying person, but also facilitate peace of mind in bereavement for everybody left behind. So we're really looking here at midwifery of dying, and if we can get it right, then people will see dying managed well. They will see good death. We can't stop it from being sad, but we can stop it from being mysterious and terrifying. We can have patients who feel safe while they're dying, and there's wonderful New Zealand research that shows that patient safety while they're dying is an important construct, and it's about not the place in which they're looked after, but the people who are around them and how much their own personhood is respected in the way that they would wish. So we can shift expectations, and then that arrow will reinforce this better set of expectations, so we can have a virtuous circle instead of a vicious circle. So slide 20 is about an invitation to all of us to tell our stories. Now, it's not necessarily that everybody needs to be writing books, but we do need to be talking in public to ordinary people about true stories. Documentaries are great at giving information, but they don't capture people's hearts and minds. It's stories that make the difference. We need good plots in soap operas. We need things coming through radio and screens and conversations with people until that understanding of normal dying is so well established that nobody remembers how they know it anymore. They just know it. So my penultimate slide, I think, is just to remind us all that this is a process. Dying is a process, and we can recognize it, we must narrate it, and we already manage it. It's not just health business, it's everybody's business. We need the media on our side, we need to capture their enthusiasm, we need the entertainment industry to see that actually the poignancy and beauty of a story well told about normal, non-sensationalized dying can be just as attractive to keeping people watching the screen as making it trivial and sensational. And we need the government to understand that while they're tinkering around the edges, thinking about assisted dying, that perhaps 0.1% of the population might benefit from, the other 99.9% of their population will continue to die and will continue to need to plan in advance and will continue to need a level of service that currently is not adequately commissioned, even though New Zealand and the United Kingdom, we're world leaders, but we still haven't got enough. It's going to need leadership, and you need to think amongst yourselves who's in the frame amongst the New Zealand palliative care community to lead it now and then to pass the baton on. It's time for us to talk about dying, and we really, really can't afford not to. So I want to finish by saying thanks. Thanks to you all for listening this morning. Thanks to the fantastic, enthusiastic welcome I've had in all the cities that I visited. It's been absolutely wonderful. I'm here because the Maxim Institute flew me over to do some public discussion of normal dying and to talk to parliamentarians. And so HarperCollins, my publisher, has laid on the in-island flights to be able to talk to so many people. I've had a most fantastic welcome from Hospice New Zealand, and they're looking after me this morning. Got a very nice cup of coffee sitting here. And the Society for Palliative Medicine of Australia and New Zealand has helped me to make contacts across the island. So that's me done, everybody. Thank you very, very much. And I think we've got to draw to a close. So I'd just like to finish, because I'm flying back to Britain tomorrow evening, by thanking everybody for such a fantastic New Zealand welcome. I've had an absolutely wonderful time. And I think I can absolutely definitely say that I'll be back with my walking boots next time to just explore the absolute beauties of your island. So thank you all very, very much indeed.
And this concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation.